The G7 summit in Elmau, Germany on June 26 to 28 and the NATO summit in Madrid, Spain 2 days later were practically useless in terms of providing actual solutions to ongoing global crises, the war in Eastern Europe, the looming famines, climate change and more. But the two events were important nonetheless as they provide a stark example of the impotence of the West amid the rapidly changing global dynamics. As was the case since the start of the Russia-Ukraine conflict, the West attempts to display unity, though it has become repeatedly obvious that no such unity exists. While France, Germany, and Italy are paying a heavy price for the energy crisis resulting from the war, Britain's Boris Johnson is adding fuel to the fire in the hope of making his country relevant on the global stage following the humiliation of Brexit. Meanwhile, the Biden administration is exploiting the war to restore Washington's credibility and leadership over NATO, especially following the disastrous term of Donald Trump, which nearly broke up the historic alliance. Even the fact that several African countries are becoming vulnerable to famines, a result of the disruption of food supplies originating from the Black Sea and the subsequent rising prices, did not seem to perturb the leaders of some of the richest countries in the world. They still insist on not interfering in the global food market, though the skyrocketing prices have already pushed tens of millions of people below the poverty line. Though the West had little reserve of credibility to begin with, Western leaders' current obsession with maintaining thousands of sanctions on Russia further NATO expansion, dumping yet more lethal weapons in Ukraine and sustaining their global hegemony at any cost have all pushed their credibility standing to a new low. From the start of the Eastern Europe's crisis, the West championed the same moral dilemma as that raised by George W. Bush at the start of his so-called War on Terror. You're either with us or with the terrorists, he declared in October 2001. But the ongoing Russia-NATO conflict cannot be reduced to simple and self-serving clichés. One can indeed want an end to the war and still oppose U.S.-Western unilateralism. The reason that American diktats worked in the past, however, is that, unlike the current geopolitical atmosphere, a few dared oppose Washington's policies. Times have changed. Russia, China, India, along with many other countries in Asia, the West Asia region, Africa and South America are navigating all available spaces to counter the suffocating Western dominance. These countries have made it clear that they will not take part in isolating Russia in the service of NATO's expansionist agenda. To the contrary, they have taken many steps to develop alternatives to the West-dominated global economy, and particularly to the US dollar, which for 5 decades has served the role of a commodity, not a currency per se. The latter has been Washington's most effective weapon associated with many US-orchestrated crises, sanctions, and, as in the case of Iraq and Venezuela, among others, mass hunger. Yeah. China and others understand that the current conflict is not about Ukraine versus Russia, but about something far more consequential. If Washington and Europe emerge victorious, and if Moscow is pushed back behind the proverbial Iron Curtain, Beijing would have no other options but to make painful concessions to the re-emerging West. This, in turn, would place a cap on China's global economic growth and would weaken its case regarding the One China policy. China is not wrong. Almost immediately following NATO's limitless military support of Ukraine and the subsequent economic war on Russia, Washington and its allies began threatening China over Taiwan. Many provocative statements, along with military maneuvers and high-level visits by U.S. politicians to Taipei, were meant to underscore U.S. dominance in the Pacific. Two main reasons drove the West to further invest in the current confrontational approach against China at a time where arguably it would have been more beneficial to exercise a degree of diplomacy and compromise. First, the West feared that Beijing could misinterpret its action as weakness and a form of appeasement. And second, because the West's historic relationship with China has always been predicated on intimidation, if not outright humiliation. From the Portuguese occupation of Macau in the 16th century to the British Opium Wars of the mid-19th century to Trump's trade war on China, the West has always viewed China as a subject, not a partner. This is precisely why Beijing did not join the chorus of Western condemnations of Russia. Though the actual war in Ukraine is of no direct benefit to China, the geopolitical outcomes of the war could be critical to the future of China as a global power. While NATO remains insistent on expansion so as to illustrate its durability and unity, it is the alternative world order led by Russia and China that is worthy of serious attention. According to Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, Beijing and Moscow are working to further develop the BRICS club of major emerging economies to serve as a counterweight to the G7. The German newspaper is correct. BRICS' latest summit on June 23rd was designed as a message to the G7 that the West is no longer in the driving seat and that Russia, China, and the Global South are preparing for a long fight against Western dominance. In his speech at the BRICS summit, Russian President Vladimir Putin proposed the creation of an international reserve currency based on the basket of currencies of the countries. The fact that the ruble alone has managed to survive, in fact flourish, under recent Western sanctions gives hope that BRICS currencies combined can manage to eventually sideline the US dollar as the world dominant currency. The global fight ahead is perhaps the most consequential since the Second World War. While NATO will continue to fight for relevance, Russia, China, and others will invest in various economic, political, and even military infrastructures in the hope of creating a permanent and sustainable counterbalance to Western dominance. The outcome of this conflict is likely to shape the future of humanity.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Natural gas is one of several commodities massively impacted by the Russia-Ukraine conflict. The European Union receives about 40% of its natural gas from Russian pipelines, about a quarter of which flow through Ukraine. And now, in light of sanctions raised against Moscow and the months-long war, energy truly seems to be at the front and center of the conflict. Natural gas prices reached record highs in October 2021, and prices have kept climbing since hitting a new all-time high in March. Prices on the Dutch TTF hub, a European benchmark for natural gas trading, more than tripled between February 16 and March 7 before pulling back. Russia has been accused of using its natural gas as an economic and political bargaining chip. But despite all this, natural gas has continued to flow to Europe, except for a few extreme cases. An example of this would be Germany accusing Moscow of engaging in power play over energy exports. This as Germany, which imports 40% of its gas from Russia, sanctioned Moscow and is now facing record inflation in light of surging prices. Now Latvia has joined Poland, Bulgaria, Finland, Netherlands, and Denmark in being cut off from Russian gas. Gazprom says it has halted gas supplies to Riga in light of their violation of supply conditions. While Russia did not specify the violations, it had already cut off gas supplies to the other countries for refusing to pay in ruble. Riga had already decided to ban Russian gas imports from January 2023, and last week it even said it was not buying Russian gas from Gazprom. And on Saturday, Latvia said that Gazprom's decision would have little effect on the country. But while many European countries have expressed similar remarks in light of Russia's bans and rises in energy prices, their decisions seem to be going against their national interests, mainly as they have made such remarks while failing to find alternatives to cheap Russian gas. So what seems to be the case is a political decision at the expense of the people who have thus far incurred the unbearable rising costs of living.
Well, no. There is a very high-stakes game of geopolitical poker going on here, and Europe does need Russian gas. At the same time, these countries, many of them, I mean Latvia, Poland, Bulgaria, are in the forefront, Poland, in the forefront of countries that want to defeat Russia, basically. I mean, they believe they have the moral high ground, that they have a good cause, but they really want to stick it to Russia. That is their goal.
Russia is the largest exporter of natural gas globally and the second largest producer behind the US. For decades, Russian natural gas has powered European homes and industries. In 1968, Austria and the Soviet Union signed a gas deal, and in the early 70s, natural gas shipments began arriving in West Germany. But a 1981 CIA intelligence assessment of a proposed 3,000-mile-long natural gas pipeline from Siberia to Western Germany warned of a trouble ahead. It said the pipeline would be a reliable source of gas for the continent, but would also give the Soviets political leverage over Europe. Now, those problems are ringing true, but only since EU and the US have sanctioned Russia, leaving Russia with no choice but to exert energy pressure on Europe. As Russia tightens its chokehold on supplies of natural gas, Europe is looking everywhere for alternatives. Coal is back on the table and deals are being struck with new partners. Despite all this, fears are growing across the continent that a Russian gas cutoff will force governments to ration fuel, risking both jobs and people's lives. Now the race to find alternatives to Russian gas has accelerated, but the question remains as to what happens if the economies tank badly, as they seem to be, and no alternatives are found. Will the EU unity against Russia fall apart?
I do not know the answer to that. Certainly, this puts great stress on European unity. In the long term, there are alternatives to Russian energy. Although Russia, you know, it's attached to Europe, it's part of the greater Eurasia region, and it is a source of not just gas and oil, but many, many other raw materials, which are now being cut off, and Europe and Russia are having a really painful divorce, and it's the Europeans governments mean for Russia to suffer the pain, but in fact, in a form of blowback, they are suffering it too.
Indications that such unity is bound to fall apart are already emerging. Some EU leaders are already calling for a reconsideration in the bloc strategies. Some have even labeled Europe's attempts of replacing Russian gas as being on a knife on edge. But despite the heavy costs incurred by Europeans, the bloc's leaders seem to have set their eyes on continuing their way, and experts say their problems may only worsen in the future.
The U.S. economy has entered a recession. Based on the official definition of a recession, when the economy contracts for two consecutive quarters, that is the definition of a recession. Recession fears for the U.S. have been ongoing for some time. One of the factors which speeded up the decline of the economy was energy prices, which have affected the prices of goods, from food to basic stuff, leading to inflation. The U.S. is experiencing over 9% inflation, something it has not experienced in over four decades.
The American economy is being bashed from pillar to post right now by a whole range of factors, but certainly it's going into recession because there's severe headwinds being caused by, first of all, the government cutting back on its spending in a ridiculous attempt to balance its budget, which it should not be trying to do in the first place, and then high interest rates compared to what they have been in the recent past, even though they're below the rate of inflation, and meaning that households are no longer borrowing, and in fact they're probably paying their level of debt down.
The U.S. president has been trying to portray this as a temporary phase, which the U.S. economy will overcome.
We're not going to be in a recession, in my view. The employment rate is still one of the lowest we've had in history. It's in the 3.6 area. We still find ourselves with people investing. My hope is we go from this rapid growth to steady growth.
But as things are going, especially the war in Ukraine, this is anything but temporary. The mayor of New York has painted an even bleaker picture. He has said that we are in a financial crisis like you can never imagine. Wall Street is collapsing. We are in a recession. The poor state of the U.S. economy is typical to many economies around the world, especially the ones in Europe. One of the telltale signs is the price of energy, which has affected Europe so badly that economies in countries like Germany, the UK, France, and Italy are all experiencing GDP contractions or slow economic growth. The Ukraine conflict is definitely one factor weighing down on the economies, but it would be wrong to blame the negative economic performance just on the war itself.
No, I don't think the government's done a good job because all last year this began. And they did nothing because they thought it was temporary. And, you know, during the pandemic, everybody got passed out money, including stores and all of that. And so it's like too much money floating around. They were very late to the game. And I don't think the administration's really put it as a very high priority.
Consumers are being bashed by inflation running about 5% per year higher than wage rises. Now, in that situation, consumers are likely to be trying to do everything they can not to spend.
The U.S., similar to Germany, is carrying a deficit. That is when companies import more and export less, dynamic that weighs down on the GDP. Yet, the future looks bleak. As economies are still facing the COVID pandemic, with supply chains not fully recovered, the U.S. is pursuing an aggressive policy towards China, which involves a trade war. Europe is bound to follow the U.S. lead, which can only make matters worse for their economies.
The United States has given the green light to more arms sales to East Asian nations in a bid to counter China. The package of arms and munitions, which is worth $900 million, has been approved by the State Department and is set to be sold to Australia, Japan, and Singapore. A potential deal with Australia includes 80 Lockheed Martin precision-guided air-to-surface missiles and associated equipment. The deal, which is said to be worth $235 million, will allow Australian jets to stay outside the range of the opponent's air defense units while launching attacks. Back in April, Canberra approved that $2.44 billion US dollars worth of, quote, improved weapon capabilities be quickly delivered to the country from the US. Australian officials claim they need the equipment to meet the country's increasingly complex and challenging strategic environment. The package for Japan would include 150 advanced medium-range air-to-air missiles. The missiles, which are to be installed on the country's F-35 fighter jets, are worth more than $290 million. Singapore will receive $630 million to supply its fighter jets with air-to-air missiles. Australia, Japan, and Singapore are considered US allies in the Indo-Pacific region against what Washington describes as the rising threat from China.
Yeah, this one, these sales of weapon to Japan and Singapore basically came after a speech of General Milley, where he complained about the aggression, the posture of the Chinese military, especially the pilot, when they intercept any aircraft from the United States or from their ally. So they said that they wanted to give a weapon to be effective against possible interception of aircraft.
The sales of advanced weapons to U.S. allies in the region come amid rising rivalries between the United States and China. Washington is pursuing a policy of cooperation and coordination with regional countries against China. It aims to push these countries to contribute more to joint regional military programs. It's now believed that the United States, which has been the preeminent military power in that region for decades, can no longer guarantee by itself a regional balance of power. Global geopolitics is changing, contrary to the expectations and demands of politicians in Washington. It's now an open secret that China is a rising military and economic powerhouse in the East Asia region. With major advances in missile technology, naval forces and intelligence, China is well on its way to becoming world-class military power. It has already surpassed Washington in several areas. And apart from that, China has massive economic ties with the regional countries.
With the exception of four countries that are already, for historical reason, very much linked to the United States from a military point of view, it means South Korea, Japan, New Zealand, and Australia. All of the other countries here are quite difficult that they can enter in a kind of alliance, a military alliance, as the NATO in Europe. There are many reasons. There are political reasons, but also economic reasons, because China is growing so fast and their economy, the economy of these countries, are very much interconnected with the China one.
China is concerned about the belligerent rhetoric coming from the U.S. Beijing and Washington have been at odds over several issues in recent years, including trade and the South China Sea. But Beijing's ultimate concern is Washington's meddling in Chinese Taipei. China has made it clear that it will not allow the self-ruled island to secede. It has already strongly warned against a potential visit by the U.S. House of Representatives Speaker Nancy Pelosi. And the dispute over the strategic island may prove to be a real challenge between the two superpowers in the coming years.
Tensions are rising between China and the United States. Beijing has issued a stern warning against a potential visit by the U.S. House of Representatives Speaker Nancy Pelosi to Chinese Taipei. Beijing says that Washington will be responsible for the consequences of the possible visit. Chinese side has made it clear to the U.S. that it is firmly opposed to Speaker Pelosi's visit to Taiwan. We are fully prepared. If the U.S. goes its own way, China will certainly take firm and forceful measures to safeguard its national sovereignty and territorial integrity, and the U.S. should be held responsible for any serious consequences.
So the idea that she would visit Taiwan at this point is intended to provoke a crisis with China. Recall that the U.S. and the British forced NATO expansion, totally ignoring Russia's security interests with the so-called reverse Cuba Missile Crisis, whose purpose was to provoke Russia into acting against the neo-Nazi regime in Ukraine in order to justify the wildly illegal and self-defeating sanctions, economic warfare against Russia.
Analysts believe the latest warning by China against the visit of the U.S. House Speaker to Chinese Taipei was harsher in tone and very stern. Some say the threats contained an allusion to a possible military confrontation between China and the U.S., and that is why reservations have been raised in Washington about the visit. The U.S. House Speaker was scheduled to visit Taipei earlier in April, but the trip was apparently canceled after she contracted COVID. However, some reports say that Pelosi will make the controversial visit in August. Apart from top Democrats, some hawkish Republicans have also come out in favor of the visit, stressing that this visit is a show of support against China.
This is a very serious crisis. How China responds is very difficult to foresee, but it's a moment in which the literally madmen and women in the West are trying to do to China what they are in the process of doing against Russia.
There are few people today who doubt that China is a global superpower, both militarily and economically. In terms of the economy, China's economy has continued to grow over the past few decades and is well on its way to overtake the U.S.'s by the year 2030. In terms of military and technology, China is now a superpower on par with the U.S., although Washington's military budget is still the largest in the world. Politicians in Washington who are still dreaming of a unipolar world order that came into existence following the collapse of the Soviet Union do not tolerate the rise of China. The first sign of the unease began to emerge after the former U.S. President Barack Obama announced his pivot to Asia policy, which was meant to counter China's rising influence. Obama's successors, Trump and Biden, have continued Washington's anti-China rhetoric. The two superpowers are locked over a number of issues, including trade and the South China Sea. The bone of contention is Chinese Taipei, and Beijing has made it very clear that it will not allow the self-ruled island to become independent.
It really can only be averted at this point by the nations of the West recognizing that they have no solution to the now terminal breakdown of the dollar system, the hyperinflationary collapse, other than sitting down with Russia and with China in a new Bretton Woods conference to replace the now completely broken and destroyed Bretton Woods system that was set up by Franklin Roosevelt and has been systemically taken apart over these last 30 years.
Chinese Taipei is under China's sovereignty and under the One China policy. The United States and other countries have recognized that sovereignty. But Washington, in violation of its own stated policy, and in an attempt to irritate Beijing, has increased diplomatic contact with the Chinese Taipei.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به حق تعالی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, in the previous episode, you heard the account of Imam Khomeini's proposal for marriage to Khadija Saqafi, whose father was one of the renowned ulema in Tehran. If you remember, it was said that there was opposition towards this marriage, as the girl was from a rich family and might not tolerate tough conditions of a clergyman like young Sayyid Ruhullah, who had little material facilities and was seriously engaged in a struggle against the puppet tyrannical regime. Today you will hear more on the issue. Stay tuned, please. Lady Khadija Saqafi's father raised several conditions for her daughter's marriage with Imam Khomeini. Firstly, he had not married before. Secondly, he had no children. Thirdly, he should be rich enough to administer an ordinary family. Fourthly, he should not transfer his wife's house to Khomeini. Mr. Lavasani informed Sayyid Ruhullah of the conditions, and the latter accepted all of them. Thus, Khadija's father took a handwritten promise from Imam Khomeini not to change the daughter's residence. The young couple resided in a small house in Tehran. They stayed in this house for a few months as Sayyid Ruhullah decided to go to Qom to attend the courses in the seminary of that city. Lady Khadija Saqafi relates the story as follows. A few months had passed since our marriage. It was the Nowruz of 1309. The house rent had expired and spring was near. The classes were going to begin in Qom. The groom, this diligent student, was very enthusiastic. He was just thinking of Qom. In other words, he was preparing me to leave for Qom. He was eager to go while I was not. He would insist and I would keep silent. I knew that there was no escape and we should go, but I could not give up soon. It was hard for him to stay, while for me it seemed impossible to leave, as I didn't like Qom for living with a person whom I had not got used to yet. I was very scared. Imam Khomeini's wife continues her account on leaving Tehran for Qom. I had accepted to live with Mr. Ruhullah. Now, against my will, I had to leave Tehran, my parents, sisters, and brothers, who all live there. I had to leave everyone for a place where I would be lonely. But accompanying the husband is a principle, and I had to live up to the determinations which God has set and I have accepted. I should accept them with satisfaction as it determines my happiness in this world and the hereafter. The Quran says it may be that you dislike something while it is good for you, and it may be that you love something while it is bad for you. Therefore, young Khadija set out for Qom, although she knew that life in that city would surely include many problems. Lady Masume, peace upon her, was her only companion in that lonely city, as she says, till the end of staying in Qom. Whenever I was upset or sad, I would go to Lady Masume's shrine. I would cry there and clean my eyes. Then I would return home with a happy heart and joyous face. After all, I had made the decision when I wanted to come to Qom, as I had no one other than Lady Masume to confine with. Imam Khomeini and his wife left Tehran for Qom on Farvardin 14th, 1309, corresponding with April 3rd, 1930. Lady Khadija Saghafi relates the account. Finally, we were to set out. The truck was hired, and it was the first time that I was traveling in such a vehicle. My dowry was loaded on the trunk, and we were placed on narrow seats. Some others also got on the truck. I was crying right till Hassanabad. After nearly 3 hours of crying, Mr. Ruhullah said, "That's enough. Have patience." I was silent and choked my feeling, which caused me sore throat. The young couple rented a small house after 1 week of staying at a friend's home. Khadija soon made friends with the wife of the owner. She says, "In my first letter to my mother, I wrote that, in spite of being lonely, I have found a good friend, and Mr. Ruhullah has rented a nice house which has 14 fruits. Do not be sad for me. Imam Khomeini's first child, Mustafa, was born in this house, only to decrease his mother's loneliness." Imam Khomeini's third residence was located in an old neighborhood in Qom. The rental was hard for the couple to pay, as young Ruhullah wouldn't like to receive the stipend from the sources of emulation and had made himself content with the income that he would get sporadically from his paternal real estate in Khomein. Lady Khadija Saghafi relates the story. "The rental was a little high for my husband. We led a life of a seminary student in or a small house. Mr. Ruhullah had a small real estate in Khomein, which we tried to make ourselves content with, that not to show our need. He would never accept any stipend and was very magnanimous. However, the revenues of the real estate were not regular for us to rely on. We had to live in tough conditions for 6 months so that the wheat in Khomein was sold to get our share to pay the debts. Yet, Mr. Ruhullah preferred hunger for his child rather than accepting the stipend, although other ulama and students would receive it. He was very knowledgeable, and the sources of emulation were ready to pay him other amounts of money, but he would never accept. He let us taste hardships to taste freedom. I tolerated patiently so that he remains Haj Agha Ruhullah. At last, I brought those hardships to their knees." Dear listeners, the revenues of Imam Khomeini would receive little of his father's real estates and farms in Khomein. But this does not mean that he had a poor family. His father was a very generous man who used to spend great parts of his revenues to the poor and the needy. The family would feed hundreds of people during wars and famines. He had a lot of properties, farms and gardens in the villages around Khomein, but he used to spend the revenues mostly for charity and religious schools. Lady Khadija Saghafi recommends the young generation try to live simply, try to be content, try not to be indebted to anyone for a better and wealthier life. If a person wants to live with dignity and pride, he or she should heed lest the luxuries of this world may not deceive him or her.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is the text of the speech delivered on June the 28th, 2022, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the head of the judiciary branch and a number of the top officials and employees of the judiciary. Fortunately, Mr. Mohseni, the head of the judiciary, is a faithful revolutionary person. The first point is with regards to the document on fundamental transformation that he talked about. The document on transformation is one of the most progressive documents for change. First, it was prepared. Later, it was revised during the time of Mr. Raisi. Important points were added and it was completed in that revision. So this document should be acted upon. The esteemed head of the judiciary is committed and he follows up on things. But matters must be followed up on at different levels. Judges, staff and managers must follow up on matters too. But based on the reports that I have received, some are not doing completely the things that one thinks should be done in this area. According to this document, a workforce should be trained. As has been frequently said, personnel need to be trained. Action should be taken in accordance with this document. That is, the judiciary must not be passive in the face of rumours, talk, opposition to it, and the like. There is a straight path in front of it, and it should follow and move along this path with strength. The judiciary should not be influenced by rumours and whether some people like what it has done and some people dislike it. This is the first recommendation.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today. And that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
My second recommendation is that the issue of fighting corruption should be taken seriously. Corruption exists. Mr. Mohseni told me something good in one of these recent events. He said apparently this is what he meant. That they had decided to first fight corruption within the judiciary itself. Yes, that's a good action to take. It is not true to say that no corruption exists within the judiciary. Of course, the majority of judges are honest, noble, faithful, hard-working, and truly honourable people. There is no doubt about this. But if there are 10 bad people in a group of 1,000 people, they can harm the rest of the group in terms of their reputation, in terms of work and the like. You have to look for those 10 bad people. However, the main task is to confront the structures that bring corruption.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. I want to thank you for bringing me home.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
The logic behind Imam Hussein's uprising. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Imam Hussein, peace upon him, left Medina for Mecca on 27th of Rajab 68. But before setting out, he wrote a letter to his brother Muhammad ibn Hanafiyye. He wrote in a part of the letter, "This is a testament which Hussein son of Ali writes and gives it to his brother Muhammad ibn Hanafiyye. I testify that there is no deity except the one creator, and I bear witness to his oneness. And I testify that Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, is God's servant and God's messenger and was sent from God. I testify that paradise and hell are true and the day of resurrection will occur and there is no doubt in it. And I testify that God will revive all the dead." Then Imam Hussein, peace upon him, explains the motive for his movement as follows. "O God, be witness and let others know that I have not started this movement as an ambitious, pleasure-seeking, seditionist, and unjust person. Rather, I seek reform in my grandfather's ummah. I want to bid what is good and forbid what is evil. And I want to act according to the practice of my grandfather and father." Imam Hussein's words and the words of other imams are the best and most reliable documents to reveal the logic behind his movement. Revival of genuine Islam and cleansing the distortions from Islam were the motive behind Imam Hussein's great movement. The distortions and innovations which had happened during 20 years of Muawiyah's rule had turned into principles, and the religion of God was on the precipice of total collapse and annihilation. Yazid, the licentious son of Muawiyah, was the corruption incarnate. He was the embodiment of every evil and sin. If Muawiyah would pretend to be religious to deceive masses, Yazid wouldn't observe religious codes and principles even in public. In his Hajj pilgrimage, Yazid took part in drinking and revelry near the mausoleum of the Prophet in Medina. Officials and influential figures were opposed to Yazid's succession of Muawiyah, but they agreed with this issue out of the fear of Muawiyah. Imam Hussein, peace upon him, seeing the depth of perversion and corruption in the Islamic Ummah, understood that there was no way except a great revolution to salvage the whole Ummah. In one of his sermons, the Imam said to Muslims, and indeed all free-spirited people in history, "Do you not see that truth is not practiced and falsehood is not forbidden? In such conditions, a faithful should wish to meet his Lord by death." In one of the texts of Ziyarat, or standard form of salutation of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, we address the Imam with the words, "I testify that you made God's halal as halal and God's haram as haram. You maintained prayer, gave zakat. You bade what is good and forbade what is evil. I testify that you practice fairness and justice and invited to these two." Great concerns of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, was the silence of influential figures against the corruption and deviation of the Umayyad regime. In fact, their silence and seclusion from the social affairs had set the ground for spread of corruption by the ruling system. Had the course of leadership not changed after the Prophet, Imam Hussein, peace upon him, wouldn't have been forced to stand against corrupt rulers at the cost of sacrificing his life and that of his companions and captivity of the children and womenfolk of the Prophet's progeny. In view of this, before leaving Mecca for Kufa, Imam Hussein delivered a very strong and fiery sermon among a group of ulema and elites of various Islamic lands. In this sermon, the Imam seriously censured the taciturnity of ulema against anti-religious policies of the Umayyad regime and called any compliance and compromise with the regime as an unforgivable sin. Then he clarified his motive of uprising. "O God, you know that what we have done has not been for rivalry and competition in ruling and excessive demands of the petty material of the world. It has rather been done for demonstrating the signs of your religion and revealing reform in your lands. We want your oppressed servants to be secure and your obligations, traditions, and laws to be practiced." The public negligence and inattention to innovations and corruptions of the Umayyad ruling system also was a great concern for Imam Hussein, peace upon him. The Imam thus started his movement to revive insight among people and awaken their hearts and minds. If they distinguished between truth and falsehood, they would choose the right path. Imam Hussein stood against Yazid to the last drop of his blood to awaken dormant consciences. In another ziyarat for Imam Hussein, we address God with the words, "Hussein sacrificed the blood of his heart to salvage your servants from ignorance and bewilderment of misguidance."
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Lebanon's leaders have once more met with the U.S. energy envoy, who is in Beirut for talks. President Michel Aoun, Prime Minister-designate Najib Mikati, and Parliament Speaker Nabih Haberi have reportedly given the envoy a unified Lebanese proposal, which the envoy will be taking to the Israeli side for a response. Amos Hochstein told reporters after the meeting that he was optimistic that a demarcation agreement will be reached in the coming weeks.
I remain optimistic that we can make continuous progress as we have over the last several weeks, and I look forward to coming back to the region and being able to make the final arrangement.
This comes one day after Hezbollah's resistance movement released footage of gas barges in the Quraysh field, their coordinates and a surface-to-sea missile, warning the Israelis that wasting time is not beneficial.
The video released by the resistance will strengthen Lebanon's position as a party in the talks and will give the three leaders a new bargaining chip, just like the Hezbollah drones help move the talks forward and bring Hochstein back to Lebanon. The coming hours will be decisive, and we will see realistic steps and will most probably go back to indirect talks in Nakhura. But we have very little time.
Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah also repeated that all Hezbollah wants in this file is to help Lebanon and give the state elements of strength in the negotiations.
If we cannot drill and take out our wealth, so nobody else will do. And we are waiting until we see if Hochstein has in his trip to Lebanon any solution to lift off all the sanctions against Lebanon.
Said Nasrallah said in light of the outcome, Hezbollah will decide how to act in the coming period.
Lebanon's President Michel Aoun has stressed that he will not be lenient when it comes to Lebanon's right to its natural resources. He also said he will no longer accept that Lebanon be the subject of discrimination as it has in the past. The statement is backed by what seems to be a new strategy by the resistance, which could give Lebanon the upper hand in the maritime talks. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Prince Charles, Britain's heir to the throne, in yet more hot water for accepting questionable donations to his charitable fund, this time from a family whose name brings back horrifying memories. Bakr and Shafiq bin Laden, wealthy construction magnates and half-brothers of the dead Al-Qaeda terrorist leader Osama bin Laden, reportedly donated $1.7 million to a charitable fund that the prince is the patron of.
The future king allegedly greenlighted the donation after meeting one of the bin Laden brothers in the palatial building known as Clarence House in 2013, only 2 years after U.S. Special Forces killed a 9/11 mastermind in the east of Pakistan.
The prince's office denies any wrongdoing, saying the decision to accept the money was made by the fund's trustees. To those observing the royal family for years, something bigger is at play.
What I think is happening is in Britain at the moment, we're in a transition going from the Elizabethan age, if you will, to a new era in the royal family, which is Prince Charles. And I think what they're doing is cleaning out the closet and getting rid of any skeletons which could shadow or cast a shadow over his accession to the throne.
In February, claims of a cash for honor scandal involving a Saudi businessman, a police investigation into another of Charles's charitable foundations ensued. And before that, reports that between 2011 and 2015, the prince accepted donations totaling $3.2 million to his charity from a former Qatari prime minister, with the cash delivered in shopping bags.
The optics aren't good. And if this money was being received in the Kremlin or in Tehran or another country that's at odds with the West, you can imagine the outcry and the pompous invective that would be spouted towards those countries.
It remains to be seen if the prince will be investigated over this latest revelation. And with an upcoming documentary featuring the life of his deceased former wife, Princess Diana,
scrutiny of the 73-year-old royal will intensify. Saeed Pourreza, London.